This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross.
My guest, Christina Applegate, was a teenager when she became famous for her role as Kelly Bundy, the daughter in the hit sitcom Married with Children. She went on to star in other TV shows and to star with Will Ferrell in the movie comedy Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy. Now Applegate stars in the new Netflix series Dead to Me, which the people behind the series describe as a tramedy, a comedy drama that deals with trauma and with guilt. Applegate plays Jen, a grieving widow raising two children. Her husband was recently killed in a car accident. She's expressing her grief through anger, like in the opening scene when a well-intentioned neighbor knocks on Jen's door, offering a dish she's prepared for Jen and her children.
So you just heat it up at 300 and leave it in for 35 minutes.
Thanks, Karen. You really don't have to.
It's my take on Mexican lasagna.
Great.
It's nothing. We just don't want you to think you're alone. Jeff and I are here for you if you ever want to talk.
Thanks.
Just can't imagine what you're going through.
Well, it's like if Jeff got hit by a car and died suddenly and violently. Like that.
Jen starts going to a grief support group where she's befriended by Judy, played by Linda Cardellini, who explains she's there because her fiancé died of a heart attack. But nothing is as it seems in this series, which is filled with surprising plot twists and character revelations. All of season one is streaming on Netflix. This week, the series was renewed for a second season. Christina Applegate, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
It's really hard to talk about the storyline of this series because there are so many reveals, so many kind of surprising twists and turns that I feel like almost anything I can say is a spoiler.
So yeah.
How do you deal with that?
Oh, well, it was really hard when we were promoting the show before it had aired or dropped or whatever they say at Netflix, trying to talk about what the premise of the show was because we really couldn't say anything. There were like 18 different spoilers that we weren't allowed to talk about. So that was really difficult. Now that most people have seen it, if you haven't seen it, I won't spoil it for you. It's been hard to not let anyone know because it is like every episode has its cliffhanger and its reveals and its secrets.
What we can say for sure is that the two main characters, yours and Linda Cardellini's characters, are both dealing with grief. And what did you think of the idea of dealing with grief comedically?
Well, as Liz always says,
she's the creator of the series.
Yes, she's the creator of Dead to Me. There is always in that darkest parts of your life, you're trying to find the humor in life because you need some repose. And I think that the way it's written is not jokes. It's people just trying to like have a minute away from all the pain that they're feeling. And, you know, and also people, you know, I always think that people crying is pretty funny anyway. but I love the idea of this grief being so completely messy and unexpected and unapologetic, especially for my character, Jen, who's operating in the world not from any kind of thought. She's really just trying to survive. She's trying to keep her head above water. And there's a lot of shame in that. There's shame in like not stopping your grief when everyone wants you to stop your grief. I mean, I've been there. I've had times in my life that were so incredibly painful. And I, in other people's eyes, wasn't dealing with it the way I should have dealt with it. And that's really hard because you don't know how how else to deal with it but the way that you are feeling.
Were you grieving for a person when you went through that or the loss of something else?
I've lost people and, you know, health issues and things like that all kind of around the same time a few years ago. So that was a really dark time. So I really related to that when I got the script, and it's not something I had to really pull from. It just lives there. It lives in the fibers of your being and in your spirit and in your soul. It stays there.
You mentioned grieving for health reasons, for body reasons. I'm thinking you're probably referring at least in part to your double mastectomy.
Well, yes. That was a really tricky time.
Yeah, this was in 2008?
Yes.
So, like, can I ask you a few questions about that? Is that all right? You've been public
sure.
about it. A lot of women go through this, and I think it's helpful to hear people talk about it. There's nothing shameful about it.
There's nothing shameful about it, but there is that feeling that's there. And I think that's one of the reasons I wanted it to be in the show.
We haven't mentioned that yet. It's in the show.
Yeah, well, it's in the show.
And we find out about it a little deeper in, but it's one of the things that has kind of interfered with intimate relations between your character and her now late husband. So was it your idea to put that in the show?
Yeah, and I think they beautifully put it in there, that it wasn't something that we harped on. It was something that Jen, like, very flippantly kind of mentions that, you know, like, wants to just sort of dismiss it at first. But then come episode 9, when she talks about the pain of it, I think it was important for women who have gone through this to be heard. Because so often we're told, like, you know, people would constantly say to me, well, you know what? The good point is that you saved your life and this, but, and God, man, when you're going through it, those kinds of reactions are really disturbing because no one really understands how you actually feel. And I think I did a disservice to myself at the time in a way by kind of being a champion for it and not being really honest with my own self about how I felt. And I think that's why I wanted to sort of live that out and let women who have gone through it know that it's, that we all feel, in Jen's words, disgusting sometimes.
Yeah, so what were some of the things you felt you weren't being totally honest about because you were trying to be like a role model?
I was trying to be a role model, but I was also trying to lift myself up. You know, and denying myself sort of those feelings because those feelings are there. It's been many years for me, so I'm much more used to, you know, my life, my body now. You know, but it's an amputation, and you physically and emotionally go through so much when you lose a part of you, especially a part of you that defines you as a female and all of those other things, and it gives, you know, it feeds babies and there's a lot of reasons that it's a very personal surgery.
Were you already a mother when you had the double mastectomy?
No, I was not.
So you became a mother afterwards?
I did.
Which means you did not breastfeed.
I did not. And guess what? She's completely healthy and fine.
Right,
and smart,
right.
And brilliant and completely right. Attached to her mommy.
So you must have really kind of missed the idea of having breasts when you became a mother.
Yeah, that was difficult. That was sad because I would hold her and be feeding her and really had wanted to have that experience, something that I will never be able to have. And it was, I went through a lot with that. But had I not had the surgery, I wouldn't have had a child because I would not be alive. So it all kind of was okay.
Yeah, so you had breast cancer in one breast, but then you got the genetic test. Your mother had breast cancer too. She survived. And you
yes.
got the test, the genetic test, and found out that you were positive for the BRCA1 gene, which is the gene that is believed to be connected to breast cancer. And that's what made you decide to...
And ovarian.
I didn't know about the ovarian. Really?
Yeah. My mom had both breast cancer and ovarian cancer, and she's BRCA. My cousin passed away right after my surgery from ovarian cancer. She was BRCA. So, yeah, there's definitely, apparently a tie between those two things. Your chances of getting ovarian cancer when you're BRCA are 50%. And your chances of recurrence of breast cancer is somewhere between 75 and 80%.
Was this a hard decision to make, or were you confident that you had to do it?
I was very against the idea of it for a long time. My doctors were trying to convince me, and I was very against the idea. And then it hit me one day, just, do I want to be having this hanging over my head for the rest of my life? And no, I didn't want to be living in that kind of fear forever. it just was the right thing for me to do.
Did you say goodbye to your breasts before the surgery? I love hearing people talk about the rituals they go through right before that, because it's so interesting that women come up with ways of, like, saying goodbye to that part of their body.
I took pictures. Mm-hmm. I don't know where they are.
That's helpful.
that was a long time ago. I have no idea where they are. But they were good. So I was pretty bummed. They were a good set.
So just one other thing I want to say about the mastectomy is that you went public with it, but I would suspect in the back of your mind you were wondering not only how it will affect your life and relationships, but will it affect your work? Will it affect your roles? And I love that you kind of...
Well, considering I don't show my boobs anywhere, it wasn't like a concern for me at all. And I didn't want to go public. I had actually kept it a secret for many, 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 many months. And then I had two surgeries before my mastectomy. I had two lumpectomies months before. And it wasn't until I was in the hospital for more than a few days that someone saw me and called the tabloids or whatever. Is that like a thing? Do they still exist? Tabloids?
Yeah, they do.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Okay, unfortunately. And had called, so they had outed me basically that I was in the hospital and we had to make a statement. But I wasn't, like, my plan really wasn't to talk about it because it didn't really matter. It was my personal story. But then at the same time, you know, an MRI saved my life. And because of that, I started my foundation, Right Action for Women, which we provide funding for women of high risk for their annual MRIs, and also a website that can educate you to know what it means to be high risk and what kind of steps you can take. So that started right in 2008. So there was a silver lining in there as well.
So you became famous when you were 16 for your role as Kelly Bundy, the daughter on Married with Children. I'm going to ask you to describe the character.
Oh, Kelly Bundy.
And I'm curious if you can use the word ditzy, because that's the word everybody seems to use.
Ditzy, yeah. Lazy thinker. I guess, you know, I had to play her as a genius. You know, in her own mind, she's a genius. And a virgin. Actually, so those are my little secrets that I had about her. You know, was really a product of that time. The show had been written, and they actually had shot the pilot with two other actors playing Kelly and Bud, and then it just didn't work out, so they came back and had us do it. And originally, Kelly was kind of a tough little rebellious, almost like biker kind of chick, and it just didn't it something wasn't for me. Fitting, and luckily at that time no one saw Fox that first year.
This was like the first sitcom that it had.
It was the very
right?
first show that ever aired on Fox, and it wasn't even really a network. Well, that's what they used to tell us when it would come time for negotiations. Like, but we're not really a network, so no, you don't get that kind of money. So it kind of evolved or devolved, as if you want to call it that, after I had seen. This girl in this documentary, and I went, oh my God, I need to, that's it, that's her. So we kind of changed her up to be sort of the product of the 80s of this generation of girls that felt they needed to use their bodies to get further in the world, and the music was heavy metal, and there was, you know, sorry, pardon me, like rock sluts and videos, and sort of kind of evolved from that idea.
What was the documentary you watched?
It was called Decline of the Western Civilization,
oh,
Part
I saw
Two,
that.
The Metal Years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And there was a girl in it who, she had just won Miss Gazaris, and she was sitting there, I believe, in a white mini dress, which I had never really seen anyone wear. And they asked her, like, what she wanted to do after winning Miss Gazaris, and she said, I want to continue with my modeling and my actressing. And I went, that's the best thing I've ever seen in my entire life. And literally the next day, I went to the wardrobe people and to everyone, and I said, we're changing this up. I'm going to change it up.
Did you feel that the show was sexist in its portrayal of your character and Katie Sagal's character, the mother?
I think it was commentary on on people that are sexist. It wasn't there to operate as this is what this is. It's going like, you know, it's like, do you look at Archie Bunker and take it for face value, or do you think that Norman Lear was brilliant in going, this is a slice of American life and this is actually happening? Not to compare us to All in the Family, which I would never, but I think that the guys that created it, this was them going, okay, these people exist, but at the same time, this family would do anything for each other at the end of the day.
So the series was considered very raunchy in its time.
So tame compared to what's
out there
right now.
Oh, I know. But there was pressure from the right that this was like an anti-family show, that it was too sexualized. There was a letter-writing campaign. Mm-hmm. How much attention did you pay to that?
None. It actually made us more popular.
Made it seem more controversial and more edgy.
Yeah, we actually used to send a fruit basket to Terry Rakolta every year.
Who started the letter writing campaign.
God bless her, because thank you. We'd had a great run because of that.
Do you remember any of the specific scenes that the letter writing campaign objected to?
No, but we couldn't even air an episode that the women had their period. Like, really? Everybody? Women get their periods, and it's funny when women are together and they're cranky and they're this, and we couldn't, or she was, I think she was upset about that episode. I don't remember. I mean, we're talking 30 something years ago, so I don't really remember any specifics because it wasn't really a thing. It wasn't something that we were all shaking in our boots about.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not trying to be snotty about it or anything. I'm just saying at that time we had to continue doing what we were doing. And if we had altered the way in which we were doing things, then other people win. And I always said, if you have a problem with it, turn the channel.
So you were born into show business in a way. Your mother was an actress and singer. She sang backup on Leonard Cohen's first album. I thought that was interesting.
She did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about her career.
Her career started in New York. She was in a group called the Bitter End Singers for many years back in the 60s, early 60s. And then she made this really beautiful album called You've Come This Way Before in the late 60s, which was around the time she met my dad. And then she was in L.A. then at that time and, continued to act here and there. But then she had a baby and she was on her own. That baby was me. There's only me. I mean, I do have a brother and sister through my father and his previous wife. But, she was alone. And so that's kind of how I started doing it, is that she couldn't afford childcare. So I would end up going on auditions with her or she was part of a playwright group. And I would end up, they would put me in the plays because she couldn't find anyone to watch me. And that's kind of where it all sort of happened.
You were on screen when you were 3 months old and 5 months old. What were the roles? And were you playing your mother's
Do they call them roles? Yes, I was playing my mother's child. That's the thing.
Is it an infant walk-on?
Yes. I was playing. It was with my mom. Mm-hmm. So we did a Playtex nursery commercial. Well, she did a Playtex nursery commercial, but she had a baby, so it was perfect. And then she was on Days of Our Lives, one or two episodes or something, and that character had a baby, and luckily she had a baby. And those were my first on-screen appearances.
Have you gone back and watched them?
I haven't seen the Days of Our Lives. I don't even know where to find that. Somehow, on some talk show I was on 100 years ago, they were able to get the clip of the commercial, and it's really funny. Because she's everyone kind of talked with a mid-Atlantic accent back then, when they were actors. Everyone had a little bit of a weird accent. And she was like, she spits up less and has less gas. And that's what my mom said.
Were you adorable?
Oh, yes. Well, of course.
So since your mother was in show business and you got started when you were still an infant, because you played her infant so she could do her job without hiring a babysitter. Did that give her the impression you should keep doing this? I mean, is that how you got involved in it?
I don't know. It all sort of organically just happened. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't really remember my childhood that very well, to be honest with you. I just know that it was always just a part of my life. I was always doing it in some capacity. I was either like in an acting class. I remember being in an acting class and loving it when I was really young, probably around my daughter's age, and commercials and then episodic. It just sort of happened. There wasn't like a goal or anyone pushing anyone to do anything. It was just sort of what I did. Also, we needed another income. So, you know, it helped with, you know, our livelihood. So it just was the way it was.
You've been critical in tweets about President Trump, and you've gotten a lot of hate tweets as a result. And some people say, like, why do celebrities like weigh in with political opinions like this? Like, you know, what do you know? And what gives you the right? And you've had some.
And yet you look on their Twitter and they're doing the same thing. What gives you the right?
Yes, exactly. Which was
you
one,
work in a bank.
That was
what are you talking about, man?
So one of the things you were criticized for is like, you don't get it. And I think what you didn't get is like, well, what is it really like to be like a working American? And you tweeted back, I grew up in an abusive home. Now I make it public. Don't you dare say I don't understand. Don't you dare say I don't understand the struggles. We lived on food stamps. Don't you dare say I don't know.
God, I was so mad that day.
Yeah. It's like your character.
I was in a pissy mood.
But what's this about an abusive home?
I don't want to get into that, but I will say that I come from my past is no different and also probably a lot darker than a lot of people's. And I'm not going to say a lot darker than most people's. I'm saying that I have lived along the same lines as some of the horror stories that you hear out there. And I've lived it, I've seen it, I've lived through it. So I really do take offense when people think that I've had a silver spoon in my mouth and that I haven't seen the dark side of life.
Yeah.
And you know what? And if I hadn't, then I don't know if I could have played Jen the way that I did. So, like, that's how I kind of feel about that.
All right. Well, Christina Applegate, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Christina Applegate stars in the new Netflix series Dead to Me. It was just renewed for a second season. A new season of Black Mirror, the imaginative anthology series by Charlie Brooker and Annabelle Jones, is now streaming on Netflix. There are only 3 new installments this time around, but our TV critic David Bianculli says each of them is excellent and thought-provoking.
When CBS All Access unveiled its new version of Rod Serling's classic The Twilight Zone earlier this year, the general consensus was that the initial episodes in that new series had fallen short. Not only were they unworthy of the Twilight Zone of old, they also weren't nearly as good or as smart as a show that had begun in England in 2011, Black Mirror. Watching that show's 3 brand new installments on Netflix makes it clear that Black Mirror, in our current TV universe, claims and holds the fantasy anthology series crown. Charlie Brooker and Annabelle Jones head the team behind the series, which uses the technology of today and the possible technology of tomorrow to frame, inform, or drive its stories. Brooker wrote all 3 of these new ones, and their scope is as wide as their impact is deep. One story is about a pop star whose personality is marketed in an Alexa-type computer figurine. Another is about a driver for an Uber-type company who blames a social media company for his personal tragedy. And a third, the most haunting and daring of the 3, is about 2 video game-playing buddies who more than 10 years later try out the new virtual reality version of one of their favorite old hand-to-hand combat games. The guy trying the game for the first time and completely unaware of what he's about to get into is played by Anthony Mackie, who plays the Falcon in the Avengers movies.
Okay, what do I do?
All right, they showed me in the store. You put the game chip in.
Done.
Now grab the disc doohickey and stick it up side to head.
Left or right side?
Doesn't matter.
Done.
Okay, now hold down the sync button on the controller.
Nothing's happening.
We haven't chosen our fighters yet.
So I am
Roxanne.
Okay.
So where's my guy?
Lance.
Damn. All right, Lance, let's go.
Okay. You have to brace yourself.
Brace myself. Come on.
You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
3, 2, 1.
This episode is titled Striking Vipers after the new virtual reality video game. And it's my favorite of the three because I haven't been able to stop thinking about it. Once the two characters dove into their game, and the look and action and violence of their initial battle was established so vividly and excitingly, I was pretty sure I knew where this episode was going. But I was so wrong, and the larger questions that began being posed were so challenging, that I ended up being as blown away by the ideas as by the truly dazzling special effects. That's not to slight the other new episodes, by the way. Each of them creates a new world, introduces new characters, and sets in motion a story that ultimately goes deep in very uncharted territory. Another episode, called Smithereens, stars Andrew Scott, the sexy priest in the new season of Amazon's Fleabag, as a hired driver who kidnaps a passenger. That passenger is played by Damson Idris, who, oddly enough, has a direct connection to the new Twilight Zone series. In that show, in the Time Loop episode called Replay, he played the student heading for college, but confronted by one dangerous situation after another. And the third episode, titled Rachel, Jack, and Ashley 2, stars Miley Cyrus as a pink-wigged pop star whose manipulative manager has found a new way to exploit her. There's a tiny new high-tech toy called Ashley 2. Part artificial intelligence, part talking and dancing mini action figure that's aimed at teenage fans. And clearly hits the target, as when a young girl named Rachel, played by Angawi Rice, gets Ashley 2 as a gift and turns it on with a voice command, while Rachel's older sister Jack watches disapprovingly.
Ashley, wake up.
Hey there, I'm Ashley 2. What's your name?
Rachel.
It's so great to meet you, Rachel.
You too. Oh my God, I'm such a huge fan.
Thanks. Let's get to know each other. How old are you?
I'm 15 today.
Happy birthday. 15 is a great age.
Thank you.
So, tell me, have you got any brothers or sisters?
Just Jack. She's over there.
Hi, Jack.
Hi, face.
Jack, I think you made a bad word choice there.
Just ignore her, Ashley.
I'll make note of that.
Fans of the original Twilight Zone, hearing that, may be flashing back to the spooky Talkie Tina episode, in which a talking doll ended up terrorizing Telly Savalas and jump-starting a generation of Chucky movies. But once again, Black Mirror is interested in going somewhere new. By the end, not only do we get a strong performance from Miley Cyrus, but we get to consider some very intriguing questions about the nature of celebrity and the limits and expectations of fandom. Notice that I've said almost nothing about what actually happens in these new episodes. That's because originality and uncertainty and unpredictability aren't just ingredients in the Black Mirror stew. They are the stew. And to experience just how good and how different this anthology series is, and has been from the very start, you just have to sample it for yourself.
David Bianculli is editor of the website TV Worth Watching and teaches television studies at Rowan University in New Jersey. Coming up, we talk with journalist Amanda Little about high-tech ways to grow food designed to survive the extremes of weather in the era of climate change. This is Fresh Air Weekend. Climate change is affecting the weather, and droughts, floods, storms, and unseasonal temperatures are affecting the global food supply. Tech startups, as well as mega companies, are developing new, high-tech ways of growing vegetables and fruits, farming fish, and growing meat without harming animals. 3D food printers, laboratories where meat is grown from cultured animal cells, robots that can weed crops without using chemicals, and indoor farms where vegetables are grown without soil or sun are some of the new approaches investigated by Amanda Little in her new book, The Fate of Food: What We'll Eat in a Bigger, Hotter, Smarter World. She's traveled to 13 states and 11 countries researching changes in our food system. Her reporting on energy, technology, and the environment has been published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Rolling Stone, and other publications. She's a professor of journalism and science writing at Vanderbilt University. Amanda Little, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell us some of the ways in which climate change is affecting the global food supply.
Well, let's just start in my own region. I live in Nashville, Tennessee, and we've heard recently that in the Midwest, in Indiana, Kansas, Missouri, Illinois, Iowa, there have been terrible storms and tornadoes that have had huge impacts on grain production, soy and corn in particular. I think they've said that there's a historic delay in the planting season because of the sodden fields. The farmers just simply can't plant their soy crop because they have their, you know, there haven't been enough dry days. And the same goes for corn. In the past 5 years, in 18 states that produce the majority of corn, had 90% of their plant in the ground by now, and they have only about 55% because of the rain and flooding. So that's just sort of one example of, you know, the subtle changes that farmers are having to deal with, in this case related to flooding. But drought, heat, invasive species and insects, diseases, crop diseases and so forth have been affecting virtually every, farm in the world.
So this made me think. You write that the greenhouse gases that now threaten the future of the world's farmers are also largely produced by the farms themselves, especially the big mechanized ones. Would you explain that paradox?
That's true. It's sort of agriculture has got us into this mess, and now climate change is biting back. And I will say, you know, agriculture is one of sort of many aspects of modern civilization that's, contributing to the, global warming phenomenon. But I believe food production is responsible for about 15% to 20% of total greenhouse gas emissions globally, which is about as much or more than all transportation forms combined. And, there are huge fossil fuel inputs that go into food production and certainly into, both the farming and the distribution of that food. And it results also from livestock production, methane emissions from livestock production. So there's a cumulative effect that's been very intensive. And by the way, it goes beyond, emissions themselves. I believe it's 70% of fresh water used by humans flows to farming. Agriculture has altered, every inhabited place on Earth. And we can see the impacts of agriculture probably more than any other human activity, not just in climate change, but in the way that it's transformed rivers and lakes and land. So it's a story that's been building for millennia, since, the dawn of civilization. And it's really coming to a head right now.
Well, let's talk about some of the new high-tech ways of farming. Let's start with vertical farming. This is a form of indoor farming. Give us the basic description of how it works.
So I visited a farm in Newark, New Jersey, that's located inside an old warehouse that was once a laser tag arena. And it's in sort of an industrial part of Newark. And I walked inside and entered this sort of Blade Runner-esque sort of cathedral of indoor plant production. They grow leafy greens for now, but eventually other kinds of high-nutrient foods on trellis structures, or these stacks of trays that go up about 30, 35 feet high, metal trays. And the plants are not grown in soil, but rather they're grown into a fabric, and the roots dangle down into a nutrient mist that is continually nourishing these roots. There are other forms of indoor food production that is not aeroponic, as you call this one, but hydroponic, where the plant roots are dangling in a water solution that's continually kind of cycling through. But in this case, aeroponic indoor production has the advantage of growing plants with about 90% less water than, conventional in the soil lettuce production or crop production. And that, of course, can be a big advantage in water-scarce areas. The lights that are radiating down from right above these trays of little leafy greens that I saw are a mixture of blue and red spectrum lights that can, combined with sort of extra oxygen that's pumped in, and extra CO2 that's also pumped in into this along with this nutrient mist, can cause the plants to grow 30% or more faster than they grow in the field.
A lot of people have given up meat, and that's for several reasons, including they don't want to see cattle slaughtered, they don't want to see animals treated inhumanely in factory farms, they don't want the cholesterol of meat. So now there's like meat alternatives being grown, actually forms of meat being grown in laboratories. And basically it's from cloned cells, right?
So it's from biopsied cells that are removed from a living animal and then are cultured. So they are replicated in a sort of what they call a bioreactor, which is basically a very sophisticated crock pot. And the cells, live cells, are self-replicating. So they actually select cells that can continue to replicate themselves, which is a natural process. Cloning, I don't think, is quite accurate because cells do this on their own. That's, you know, how living creatures grow. The cells that are harvested and then cultured in the laboratory are alive. They're so alive that they, in fact, can flex or spasm, when stimulated. And this was really something that this was really got me both excited and sort of semi-terrified, honestly, about the prospect of eating this stuff, was these cells are they're living cells. They're just not attached to a sentient being. And they, in fact, die when they're harvested from the bioreactor and then are not fed oxygen any longer. And the asphyxiation then kills the cells and they are no longer reactive.
Got it. But does it have, like, the flavor of meat?
It does have a lot of flavor because what we're eating, I mean, in the meat we consume is just that. It's muscle, connective tissue, and fat. The meat that I tried, which has a lot of different names for it, we've heard sort of, you know, cultured meats is one way of putting it, cell-based meats is another, lab meats is another. But the laboratory meat that I tried was duck meat that had been freshly harvested from a bioreactor in Berkeley, California, in the headquarters of a company called Memphis Meats, which is not selling its products in the world quite yet, but has gotten lots and lots of investments from major meat producers. And there are companies producing lab meats that are also doing lab-based seafoods. And, the idea is that you can essentially do any meat that came from any kind of living animal, whether it's livestock or fish, can be produced in this manner. As long as you can sample some cells and help them replicate and grow. And in my case, the duck experience was pretty staggering because and I haven't eaten a whole lot of duck in my life, but what I did eat, which was just this kind of lump of duck meat with salt and pepper that had been sauteed in a pan, tasted very much as advertised, as meat. And there's a difference between the plant-based meat products that we're hearing about on the market, like Impossible, the Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat, and these lab meats, because the lab meats are identical on a cellular level to the meats we eat. So they're actual meat, but they're not derived from plants. They're derived from the cells of animals.
So right now, cultured meat or laboratory meat is in its experimental stages, and it's very expensive right now, too. What do you think the odds are that it will be actually available and affordable anytime in the foreseeable future?
I think the odds are very high. I think it's interesting and important to kind of note that the basic technology for growing muscle tissue has been around for a couple of decades. And this is not, you know, brand new stuff. But the work that's being done now, there are probably half a dozen or more startups that are getting very aggressively funded that are working on this. And that plan to have products available in, you know, by 2020, in the next 2-3 years. Valetti has been pretty careful about not putting, you know, a release date on his products. But it's really a matter of scale and cost. And the cost has come down from hundreds of thousands of dollars, even for an ounce of this meat, to, you know, a couple of $100 for an ounce of this meat. So it's moving very quickly, the progress on this.
Now, you say that the most surreal place that you visited on your tour of, like, new high-tech approaches to food was a place that makes a new high-tech form of freeze-dried food that is being stocked up on by many survivalists right now. So describe this factory. Should I call it a factory?
Yes, it was the chicken pot pie room at Wise Foods facility in Salt Lake City, Utah. And they were producing little Mylar pouches of freeze-dried chicken pot pie that, you know, essentially can be shelf-stable for at least a quarter century, probably much longer than that. But this is what they call prepper food, right? It's the survival food industry, and this industry has been growing very, very quickly in recent years. Just in the last few years, it's more than doubled. So one of the concerns is that we're seeing sort of diminishing government safety nets while we see intensifying environmental pressures. And a lot of people are becoming more and more concerned that in our lifetimes, we will see disruptions in our food supply. This was foreign to me because I'm not someone who I've never stockpiled food in my own home. But I had relatives and friends, including my brother, who was a climate scientist, who was beginning to stockpile survival foods in the basement of his home. And I thought, what in the world is going on and how urgent is this problem?
So how worried should I be that your brother, who is a climate scientist, is starting to stockpile food because he's so concerned about the future of climate change?
That was the driving question for this entire book. How screwed are we exactly? I was kind of surprised because it wasn't just my brother who's a climate scientist. It was also other people in my life I was beginning to notice doing this. My stepbrother, who's a business guy who lives in D.C. and has a very urban life, was doing this in his own basement. My cousin-in-law, who lives in Indiana as a former cop, was doing it at his home. And the company actually is targeting a new consumer they call guardian moms, who are worried about a stable food supply for their kids going forward. These are people who've lived through Hurricane Harvey and Katrina and Sandy, you know, lived through these once-in-a-thousand-year storms that are now happening sort of once every 50 years. They've lived through major blizzards, forest fires, flooding, and so on. And they're seeing interruptions in very local ways in their communities where they can't get to the grocery store for, a few days or more. And they're beginning to see that this might be the sort of new normal.
So what kinds of foods is the survivalist company making into a freeze-dried food that can last for a long time and help you through a disaster or catastrophe, whatever?
So they're comfort foods. There's, beefy chili and turkey tetrazzini and sort of stewy kind of comfort foods that you might associate with your grandmother or, it's the kind of food, as they say it, that can be high calorie and comforting in sort of an emergency situation.
And I guess you probably have to add water, so having it be stew-like is probably sensible.
That's right. I mean, when I tucked into my chicken pot pie, it didn't look anything like the Stouffer's version. It was sort of a tawny gruel, although it did taste very familiar to me. It tasted sort of like my grandmother's chicken casserole, and so it wasn't as off-putting as I'd like, although the notion that this would be my sole source of sustenance was pretty scary to me. And so when we think about a future in which we may lose access to these foods that are, you know, so comforting and familiar to us. And we may have to resort to Mylar packages and 3D printers and Soylent and this kind of thing. It's really upsetting. This is a topic that people have a lot of emotion about and should. And it triggers this instinct for survival and innovation.
Have you changed or reconsidered any of your eating habits as a result of writing this book?
The single biggest change for me has been the way I think about food waste. I, like many of us, get really excited when I go to the grocery store and like to buy a lot of leafy, fresh things. And I am embarrassed when I'm not able to use up all the ingredients I get for certain recipes and sort of quietly throw them away. But, you know, the broader problem of food waste is pretty staggering. I mean, we waste more than a third of all the food grown globally. It is either thrown out in homes, or it rots in transit, or is thrown out because it doesn't meet aesthetic standards. And, you know, we have very unrealistic expectations about food and how it should look and how much we should be able to eat. And we have an amazingly wasteful society. And that is a big part of the problem. So I've become much more sensitive to, you know, the amount of food we waste in our home. I certainly have become much more sensitive to my own meat consumption. I have tried to be, you know, vegetarian and vegan in the past. I love meat and I've had a really hard time letting it go. But I have become sort of much more willing to accept and sort of experiment with plant-based meat alternatives, and certainly can imagine bringing these cell-based meats or cultured meats into my kitchen when they're ready and affordable, and certainly continuing to eat meat and craft meats and support, you know, meats that are sustainably farmed is great. But I am on a limited budget, like so many of us, and so I can't, you know, only buy the really expensive sort of craft artisanal meats. And so I've thought a lot differently about that.
Well, Amanda Little, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Amanda Little is the author of the new book, The Fate of Food. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mood Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.